Hi, I'm Carrie. I work at the Community Service Society of New York, and we run the Community Health Advocates Program. So we believe that consumer assistance programs are going to be a critical part of making sure that healthcare reform works on a systemic level, but also that the folks who are going to be most affected, the 32 million people who are uninsured who are going to be getting insurance, they're generally people who have had less contact with the healthcare system, more trouble getting health coverage, and they're going to need extra help. And so we believe that consumer health programs are going to be an important part of that. We're already starting to look at New York State, the landscape of programs that serve people, and thinking about the resources that we're going to be gaining through the Affordable Care Act, thinking about how we're going to make this work around the state. And we think that consumer advocates in other states need to think about it too. So we wrote a report, which is at the back of the room. I brought 100 copies, and I don't want to carry any home. Please take one. They're also on our website and hopefully on the APHA website. And it talks about different models of consumer assistance programs so that you can start thinking about what model would work for your community. And one really exciting thing about consumer assistance programs is that they've developed organically all around the country to serve different populations and provide different services. And so there's a lot of variety and programs that are really well developed to serve exactly the folks in the community that need the help. So I'm going to be talking about things from the report, but you'll get more information from there if you grab one. So I wanted to start with a story. This is Tracy. Tracy was diagnosed with leukemia, and his doctors told him that he needed a bone marrow transplant quickly. But when they went to the hospital to get that, the hospital told Tracy and his wife, Anita, that they would need to sign an agreement to pay the $40,000 cost of a bone marrow donor search before they could start the search. And Tracy and Anita had no money, but they had no time. So they signed this agreement, and they started making payments. And then luckily, someone told them about CHA, Consumer Health Advocates, where I work. So they called us, and my coworker Ashley started looking into it and realized immediately there was a problem because Tracy's on Medicaid, and you're not allowed to balance bill Medicaid patients for services that Medicaid doesn't cover. So she contacted the hospital, got them to write a letter to Tracy and Anita saying they didn't owe the $40,000, and they refunded the payments they'd already made. So Tracy and Anita were able to focus on his health and on his treatment and not worry about how they were going to pay the mortgage. So that was an immediate benefit. But then Ashley took it to the next step. She called the Department of Health, which administers Medicaid, and told them what was going on. And so the Department of Health sent out a reminder in their next Medicaid bulletin to providers, reminding them you're not allowed to balance bill Medicaid patients. Hopefully that would help prevent this from happening in the future. So that one story covers a lot of the functions I'm going to talk about that consumer assistance programs perform. So I'm going to cover what is a consumer assistance program, how do they fit into the Affordable Care Act, what new provisions are in there for CAPS, and then I'm going to run very quickly through the different models that we talk about in the report. So consumer assistance programs, as I said, there's a huge diversity. Some programs serve just one population, like seniors. Some only help with one form of coverage, like Medicaid. Others cover all payers and all people. They're all geographically defined, but otherwise there's a huge variety. And some areas might have a variety of CAPS that help people with different issues. But in general, CAPS help people with education. We teach consumers and we teach advocates who work with consumers about the options out there. Then we help people figure out which kind of coverage they can afford or they qualify for, and we enroll them and we help them renew it when that coverage ends. We also help people find sources of free and discounted care if they're just not going to qualify for anything. We help people navigate the coverage and benefits once they've got it. We help them find a doctor who takes their coverage. We help contest a denial of coverage. We help with all of those navigation functions. And finally, we report back to policymakers. We call it the Sentinel function. A lot of people don't like that name, so if you think of a different one, tell us. But we collect data about everybody that we help. We identify trends. We talk to our advocates who are working with people, and we find out that a bunch of people have gotten denied for the same reason that doesn't make sense. And so then we're able to take that information back to the state agencies that regulate or administer the coverage, and we help them work out solutions so we stop that problem before it becomes widespread. So the ACA provides funding and a structure for two kinds of consumer assistance programs to help people with the new reforms. Luckily, Congress recognized that people were going to need help, that these were big changes. And so they provided two different forms. And I've got a little table here that compares them. The first are the CAPS. And I have the sections of the statute if you like to read things like that. But the CAPS begin immediately. Whereas the navigators, they begin, the states are required as they set up the exchanges in 2014 to include a navigator program. The funding for the CAPS, the ACA included $30 million for fiscal year 2010, whereas the navigators, the exchanges, have to figure out how they're going to fund that. Entities that can accept this, the $30 million are either state agencies that are independent agencies, or states can contract with nonprofit organizations. The statute has a really long list of different kinds of business or community groups that are eligible to take the navigator money. And finally, the functions are very different. The CAPS are required to perform all of those four functions that I mentioned. They're required to collect a lot of data and report it back to HHS so HHS can track how all these different reforms are playing out. And they're also required to help people sign up for the tax credits in 2014 when those start. Whereas the navigators, we think that's kind of a misname for the navigators. They're not actually going to do the navigation function. They're going to do education, they're going to do enrollment, and then as they receive calls from consumers who need help navigating, they refer them back to the CAPS. So it's clear that Congress has imagined that there are going to be these two different kinds of consumer assistance programs performing sort of parallel functions and working together. So that's why it's time to start thinking. What's going on in your state? Who's going to be taking these CAP and navigator roles, and how are they going to work together? How are we going to find the funding and make sure that they all work well? So the CAP money that's already been allocated, there was $30 million appropriated for fiscal year 2010. HHS kept $1 million for administration and is distributing $29 million to the states. They already awarded to 40 states and territories in October, and so those states are trying to hit the ground running with their programs. And if you go to the OSIO website, you can see a summary of what the different states said they were going to do with that money, either to expand programs that they already had existing, maybe a state agency, maybe a nonprofit, or start new programs. So the state programs are required to have personnel with expertise handling private insurance cases. They're also allowed to do public insurance programs. They have to have a toll-free hotline that's answered live during business hours. They have to have web access, and they have to have walk-in capacity. They have to be independent so that they can vigorously represent consumers. And there are very specific data collection requirements that they're supposed to report back to HHS regularly. Some states have chosen to partner with nonprofit CBOs. Community Health Advocates, where I work, we've been working with the state to try to get that money to go to community organizations through our program, and we're seeing how that's going to work out. And finally, the White House has requested an additional $30 million for fiscal year 2010. We're going to see how it goes after that. So CAPS are important because in the past they've demonstrated that they can ease these big health coverage system transformations. So some of the programs that we will be talking about, like the Consumer Health Alliance and Community Health Advocates, were created by community advocates who saw that there was going to be a huge problem as state Medicaid programs transitioned their consumers from fee-for-service to managed care Medicaid. And so they helped ease those transformations, and they've remained and taken on more and more responsibilities. Healthcare for All Massachusetts was an existing CAP. When Massachusetts had their big healthcare reform, their call volume increased by 400%. They were taking 2,000 calls a week during the biggest transformation time. And SHIPS and the Medicare 800 hotline were really critical to helping 24 million people enroll in Medicare Part D in that first year. We know that healthcare reform, 32 million people who are currently uninsured are suddenly going to be enrolling in insurance, and they're going to need this kind of help. It's going to be the biggest transformation of our healthcare system we've ever seen, and they're going to need help. So I'm going to talk a little bit about different models. The first model is the nonprofit community-based organization, and I'm going to say right now I'm really biased. I work at CHA. I think it's a fabulous model. The first way that community-based organizations have set up these programs is the helpline model. And so Healthcare for All Massachusetts was a health policy organization. They set up a helpline with one person answering the phone. People could call in from around the state and ask for help. And those helpline counselors, now there are five with volunteers and interns, and they have the backup of the policy staff. If they have a really hard question they can't answer, they can turn to the policy experts, and they can also tell the policy experts about the trends that they're seeing, and they're able to perform that sentinel function. Community-based organizations model, that's where I work at CHA. We have a hub and spokes model. So CSS, where I work, is the hub, and we do all the administration. And we have the spokes are community-based organizations. And they're organizations like food banks or immigrant organizations that work in the community. They have a location where people walk in and ask for help about a variety of issues. And so we've been able to build capacity in those small organizations. They might not have known anything about healthcare before, but we can train a staff member and fund that staff member. So when people come in to ask questions about housing, they also get help with their healthcare. And they're able to get help from people they trust in the language that they speak. And the third model, nonprofit model, is the legal services model. So this is Health Consumer Alliance in California. As I said, during the transition to managed care, Medicaid, legal services organizations around the state realized this was going to be a problem for their clients, and they created this organization. So again, they have community health workers, advocates going out into the community, talking with people, people walking into their offices, and they help on the front line. And when they have really hard cases or when there's a sentinel function issue, they're able to call on the backup of the attorneys in the organizations. So we think that one really big advantage of the community-based model is that we're able to reach out to people who aren't comfortable calling an 800 number, maybe don't have the language skills, aren't comfortable walking into the Medicaid office, would never think of calling a commercial broker. And we're able to help achieve a greater equity in health coverage. We're working in communities that are traditionally underserved, underinsured, and as you can see from these are CHA numbers from this past year. We're able to work with people who speak a lot of languages other than English, are coming from other countries, maybe don't have any sense at all about how our healthcare system works. The second model is a hybrid between nonprofit and government partnerships. A lot of people might know about the SHIPS, the State Health Insurance Program model, and it was started sort of as a volunteer organization in one state to help people navigate Medicare as Medicare got more and more complicated. And the federal government got involved and now funds programs on a state basis in every state and territory. And every one of those programs is a little different. They serve mostly people on Medicare or seniors. Some of them still use volunteers, some have paid staff, and they work through different state agencies like the Department of Aging or Insurance or Health to serve folks. And if you look at the SHIPS, you can see there's a huge diversity of ways that they're meeting the unique needs of their community and their state. The third model are government-run programs. And so these are programs like Ombuds programs, like the Office of the Governor Consumer Health Assistance Office in Nevada. It's called GovCHA. So they're part of the Office of the Governor. They help people with a variety of issues, and they're funded both through general funds and through different kinds of taxes and assessments and things. And the government advocate model, we have an example in the report of the Office of the Healthcare Advocate in Connecticut. And they help people with insurance problems, and they're also able to take a leadership role. So one of the real advantages of the government model is that bully pulpit. When you call from the governor's office and say, you know, we want help with our client, people tend to sit up and listen. The Office of the Healthcare Advocate last year was able to get intervener status in a rate case. Anthem was trying to raise their rates. And that's something a nonprofit wouldn't necessarily be able to do. They're able to have a stronger voice in some ways. The thing you have to be careful about with government models is that you have to make sure that they're very independent. If they're part of the agency that regulates insurance or administers insurance, you could have some conflicts of interest. And also, these offices can become a lightning rod. If they're very strong consumer advocates, they make people angry. And sometimes both of these agencies have almost been eliminated. And since they don't take all their funding, in fact, OHA doesn't take any funding from the general funds. The whole budget crisis explanation doesn't entirely explain why people would want to eliminate these agencies. And finally, we have private call centers. In some cases, the government contracts with a private call center, and a good example is the Medicare hotline. The advantage is 28.1 million calls. They can serve a huge volume. But the people that they have answering the calls aren't trained advocates. They don't have the lawyers or the policy folks to back them up. They get a script. So someone calls in and asks a question. And if the person's able to answer it from the script, then they help them. But a lot of people get frustrated with these automated phone services or just aren't able to navigate the help that they need. And I want to tell one more story. This is Erin. She's one of my clients. Erin lost her job. And when she lost her job, her employer decided that she didn't qualify for the COBRA subsidy that pays 65% of your COBRA premium at that time. So Erin and her parents struggled and paid her COBRA premium, which was really high. She went back to school. She was getting retrained so she could find another job. And she heard about our program. She also got a letter from her COBRA benefits administrator. It was one of those huge national companies. And they told her that her coverage was about to end. So she heard about us through some outreach we did. She called us. And as I was helping her work out the 18-month issue, because in New York State, we just passed a law that says you get up to 36 months of coverage, not 18. And so these big national organizations weren't necessarily telling people about the rights. The employers didn't necessarily know. So I was helping her work through getting 36 months, and I realized that she qualified for the premium subsidy. So I had to educate her employer and this COBRA benefits administrator, and we got her a $4,000 refund of the money that she'd paid. So she and her folks were able to use that money to keep her on the insurance. She just called me last month. She got a new job. Eventually, she'll be getting insurance, but that money that she got back is going to pay the insurance until she gets coverage. And then we worked with the state. I had to educate the employer and the benefits administrator and make sure that they gave her up to 36 months of coverage that she needed. And we're working with the State Department of Insurance to make sure that all the benefits administrators in the country and all the employers in the state know about this new benefit. We're hearing from a lot of people who are maxing out of that 18 months and have no other good options until 2014 when the exchange comes online. So in conclusion, the ACA provides funding for these CAPS and navigators. This is an important opportunity for people who care about hooking people up with coverage to figure out ways to maximize in their state the assistance that's available. CAPS are critical. They help ease these major health coverage system transformations, and they're going to be critical in the next transformation. They connect vulnerable and underserved communities to coverage and care and can help smooth out some of these inequities in coverage. And nonprofit and community-based organizations should be working with their states right now. Start talking with them. If you are interested in working on this, give us a call. We're thinking about it. We're working with people in other states who are thinking about it. We'd love to talk to you about how you can make that work in your state.